Coming up, they're juveniles who've been sentenced to life in prison without parole, often for horrific crimes. But do they deserve a second chance?
Why should these juveniles not get life in prison? Age cannot excuse what they have done.
Yuck!
And Buddhist monks who practice kung fu. It's not about hurting others. It's not even about self-defense.
It's really a form of personal cultivation.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. As Congress worked on an $800+ billion stimulus package for the deteriorating economy, religious leaders lobbied for special attention to the most poor and urged the extension of federal health benefits to more children. President Obama lashed out at Wall Street bankers for giving themselves nearly $20 billion in bonuses at the same time that they were taking billions in government aid. The president called that shameful. Obama also began reaching out to the Muslim world this week. He gave his first full-length television interview since becoming president to the Arabic language network Al Arabiya. Obama said he's committed to strengthening ties between the U.S. and Islamic nations.
We are ready to initiate a new partnership based on mutual respect and mutual interest.
Meanwhile, Obama has chosen a director for the faith-based office at the White House. Joshua Dubois will head the newly named Council for Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. Dubois is a 26-year-old Pentecostal minister who led religious outreach for Obama's presidential campaign. At the Vatican, Pope Benedict XVI is fending off outrage from the Jewish community. Jewish leaders around the world issued angry condemnations after Benedict welcomed back into the church an excommunicated bishop who denies the Holocaust. The British-born bishop was one of four that Benedict rehabilitated this week as part of an effort to heal an internal church rift. The four had been excommunicated because they were consecrated without Vatican approval. Vatican officials have said the Pope intended to offer an act of compassion toward the traditionalist bishops and that it had nothing to do with the bishop's personal views. Also this week, the Vatican announced it has launched a comprehensive study of women's religious orders in the United States. The study is being led by an American nun headquartered in Rome. Her task will be to, quote, look into the quality of life of women religious and make a confidential report. The Vatican statement highlighted concerns that the number of nuns in the U.S. has dropped dramatically over the last 40 years. In southern Africa, Roman Catholic officials appealed to the region's political leaders to denounce Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe. The bishops said their failure to respond to Zimbabwe's political turmoil has led to, quote, passive genocide. Since a disputed presidential election last March, the country has been without a functional government. The upheaval has led to a cholera epidemic and forced an estimated 80% of the population into dire need, according to the United Nations. We have a powerful story today about punishment for juveniles who commit crimes. The Supreme Court has thrown out the death penalty for such young people, but in 44 states, they can still be sentenced to life in prison without parole. Is that just for children, even for the worst crimes? Tim O'Brien reports from Tampa, Florida.
23-year-old Kenneth Young is serving life in prison with no possibility of parole for a series of hotel robberies in and around Tampa, Florida. It was June of 2000. Young had just turned 15 and was acting at the direction of 25-year-old Jacques Bethea, a neighborhood drug dealer with a long arrest record. But Thayer would hold the gun. Young would take the money.
Only thing he told me to do was get the money and the tapes, and that was it. And he
what
would,
tapes?
Like videotapes from the video cameras.
The security cameras?
Yes, sir.
And you did that?
Yes, sir.
Young says he had little choice. His mother was addicted to crack cocaine and had stolen drugs from Bethea. He believed her life was in danger.
He threatened to hurt my mama.
What did he say he'd do?
Kill her.
If you didn't go along?
Yes, sir.
Young's mother, who says she's been off drugs for more than 3 years, blames herself for the fix her son is in.
Yes, I do. I do. Because if it wasn't for the drugs, me being on drugs, then my son would be where he at today.
Young is being held at a maximum security prison in Central Florida. Under Florida law, juveniles charged with serious crimes are tried as adults. And serious crimes, like armed robbery, can bring life in prison. And in the courtroom of Judge J. Rogers Padgett, being a child didn't seem to help. It can even hurt the child who behaves like one, as Kenneth Young did.
So what we see is what we get in the way of a defendant. We get a person who shows no remorse. We get a person who is smiling in court, thinks it's funny. We have a person who, while he is under consideration for a life sentence, is flipping signals to people in the gallery.
He's only 15.
We have a person who gives no appearance of deserving any slack whatsoever in sentencing. So we give him a life sentence.
Enter law professor Paolo Anino, who runs the Children in Prison Project at Florida State University. Anino has been trying for years to get the Florida legislature to allow parole consideration for all juvenile offenders in the state, to give them a second chance. His arguments, as much moral as they are legal.
Is it your position that no juvenile should be sentenced to life without parole?
Oh, absolutely. I think we're immoral, ultimately, as a nation. This is no different from slavery or other major moral issues. Placing children in adult prisons for life is a death sentence for children. Do we want to do that as a society? Do we want to ignore our Western traditions? I mean, we do have Western traditions. And one part of our Western traditions is called redemption. And for many people in our culture, redemption is an important value.
There are some crimes that these people have committed that simply have no redemption. The victim and the public in general who know about the crime are looking for retribution.
It's all about retribution.
Retribution, right.
According to Human Rights Watch, the United States is the only country in the world that regularly sentences juvenile offenders to life in prison without parole. There are now more than 2,500. Pennsylvania has the most with 444. All but these six states allow life without parole for those under 18 at the time of their crimes.
Most of the crimes that bring life in prison without parole are far worse than Kenneth Young's armed robberies. Most involve murder, often the murder of other children, crimes that shock the conscience and break the heart.
Good morning. My name is Dawn Romig, and I'm here.
In Pennsylvania, a Senate committee held hearings last October to consider doing away with life sentences for juvenile offenders. Lawmakers got an earful from opponents like Dawn Romig, whose 12-year-old daughter had been murdered by 17-year-old Brian Barr.
We learned that Brian had made a list. It was called 23 Things to Do to a Girl in the Woods. Beat her, check. Rape her, check. Kill her, check. Everything on that list was carried out. It was an adult act he planned and executed. Why should these juveniles not get life in prison? Age cannot excuse what they have done.
I never got to say goodbye to Kimmy. I never got to see her in a casket. I now talk to her at her grave still, 10 years later, on Mother's Day. I also like to add, as I was sitting here listening to people, saying that they need second chances. My daughter didn't have a second chance. She wasn't given that choice to live or to die. And I am here to fight to make sure that these juveniles do not get released. Thank you.
What do you say to the parents of a child whose child is murdered?
Well, it's tragic, and It's very difficult. And I turned to a group that I'm associated with. It's called Mothers Against Murder Association. And their children have been killed.
MAMA Incorporated, a remarkable support group in West Palm Beach. 73 mothers, all of whom have lost a child to murder, meet at this storefront office every other Thursday. The walls are lined with the photographs. The mother with her lost child. On this day, Paula Bowe will be joining Mama's poignant photo gallery. Her daughter was shot to death by an ex-boyfriend.
And he shot her. He shot her twice, point blank. Once in the head, once in the neck.
What makes this association so remarkable is that despite their grief, members do not seek retribution. Instead, they speak out against it.
That's one thing I express and I tell my moms all the time. The only way they're going to move on, they got to learn to forgive. You know, and if they don't learn to forgive, they'll never be able to move on to the next step.
And Angela Williams should know.
I lost seven. I lost five nephews and two nieces in my family. And that was motivates me to keep going to help others. To gun violence, all of them was killed by gun.
MAMA is supporting Kenneth Young's petition for clemency on the premise that any child should be given a second chance, even for murder. Sylvia Manning is a preacher whose son was shot to death. She believes there's hope for his killer, who has yet to be apprehended.
I feel as though that whoever did this to my son, they can be redeemed. I mean, if they know Jesus, they can be redeemed.
It's a religious issue to you.
Not really religious, it's what my heart says.
Linda Battle is a Palm Beach County deputy sheriff whose son Eric was run down and killed by a drug dealer.
I work in the jails, and I see the juveniles come in there, you know, for major crimes, and they're just babies. And I, you know, I don't know what got them to that point.
What got them to that point? The U.S. Supreme Court, in rejecting the death penalty for juvenile offenders 4 years ago, relied in part on the growing body of psychiatric evidence that shows why children often fail to act as responsibly as adults.
In a nutshell, it is that the brain has not really matured. You do not really have an adult brain until you are in your early 20s.
You have actual empirical evidence.
We do.
Ratner says that magnetic resonance imaging, MRIs like this one, show that juveniles use a different part of the brain in the decision-making process than adults, making them more likely to act irrationally, less likely to appreciate the consequences of what they do.
Roughly 25% of the juvenile offenders serving life without parole for murder never murdered anybody. Rather, they were following the lead of an older adult. But under what is known in the law as the felony murder rule, they are just as guilty as those who pull the trigger, and often sentenced just as harshly.
They follow these older adults, and then the adults commit a murder. So the kid never has the gun in his hand. The kid never touches the gun. Many times...
But he's still charged with murder.
He is charged with murder and gets the exact same sentence.
An accessory is as guilty as the principal.
In the state of Florida, it's exactly the same. And that's the felony murder rule, and we have it not just in Florida, but around the country. And the felony murder rule denies the individuality of the child. It ignores the fact that you have a child here, and you're treating the child just like an adult.
Among those who have problems with that, we were surprised to find the judge who had sentenced Kenneth Young to four consecutive life terms. Judge J. Rogers Padgett said judges have no way of knowing what might become of the children who appear before them. And at least where the victim doesn't die, their fate should be left to the Department of Corrections.
If I went and talked to Kenneth, I might have sympathy too. Because I firmly believe that the Department of Corrections ought to be given the latitude to determine when these people are ready to go.
Yeah.
What do I know? At the time of sentencing, I'm doing the snapshot.
Yeah.
So what do I know? I know what.
But in Florida, as in most states, it's too late to turn back the clock. Even the sentencing judge cannot reopen this case, decided more than 7 years ago.
It's hard. It's so hard. The sleepless nights that I have had, and every time I go to see my child, And I have to leave that prison without my baby. It just takes something out of me. It hurts. It hurts so bad.
Unless Florida changes its law or the governor commutes the sentence, Kenneth Young will die in prison. He will never get out. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Tim O'Brien in Tampa, Florida.
In other news, we note the deaths this week of two men who were highly respected in the world of religion. Pulitzer Prize-winning author John Updike died of lung cancer at the age of 76. Updike was a mainline Protestant, and many of his works featured religious characters and spiritual themes. And Rabbi Leon Klinicki, a pioneer in the interfaith movement, died this week after a long illness. He was 78. Klinicki was the Anti-Defamation League's liaison to the Vatican for 30 years, working to improve Jewish-Catholic relations. In 2007, Pope Benedict made Klinicki a papal knight. The Russian Orthodox Church has a new patriarch. In Moscow, a group of more than 700 clergy and lay representatives elected Metropolitan Kirill as their new leader. Kirill succeeds Patriarch Alexei II, who died last month. For 20 years, Kirill has handled the Church's sometimes tense relations with Catholics, Protestants, and other non-Orthodox faiths. The Russian Orthodox Church has an estimated 100 million members. It's the largest branch of Eastern Orthodox Christianity. And Kung Fu. Think of Buddhist monks, and you probably imagine practitioners sitting stark still trying to quiet their minds. Who knew that the violent martial art Kung Fu has its own spiritual foundation? Lucky Severson reports on action meditation.
Many people in the Western world think Kung Fu is all about combat, about beating up the opponent. It's true that the original Kung Fu monks were legendary warriors defending one Chinese emperor after the other. But there is another side to this martial art, perhaps the most important one, according to Berkeley professor of religious studies Robert Scharf.
They say this is not actually about harming human beings. It's not even necessarily about defending oneself. It's really a form of personal cultivation.
Jay Hobner, a fundraiser for a nonprofit charity, says she has benefited.
I practice Kung Fu because it's a combination of going to the gym and the therapist. And it's also, I found a spiritual home here as well.
How?
Because I think that the reasons people go to church are the same reasons a lot of us come here, for that sense of spiritual renewal.
There is a spiritual side to Kung Fu. It's called Chan Buddhism, and through it, Kung Fu becomes an instrument of enlightenment.
You must understand they're one, not two. Just like our mental and physical. We have to understand that's one piece, one body.
Here, come on, go! 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 Xi Yanming is a 34th generation Shaolin monk, a Kung Fu master who defected from China in 1992. He's established a Shaolin temple and Kung Fu school in downtown Manhattan.
That's why I defected. I want to spread the Shaolin philosophy, our martial arts, to the rest of the world.
A fundamental precept of Buddhism is that the mind must be emptied of all worldly desires through meditation, and only then can a person become enlightened. Yanming says that martial arts are action meditation. In other words, focusing so intently on the complex moves of Kung Fu that the mind empties all of life's anxieties.
The point of Buddhist meditation, there's many different kinds of Buddhist meditation, but the point of most of them is to quiet and ultimately still that inner voice, because they believe when you still the inner voice, then who we really are comes forward. It just becomes naturally apparent.
For me, this empties my mind as better than any kind of sitting meditation. I've done yoga. This does it. You don't have a thought in your head for 2 hours. And just that blankness that kind of, for me, refreshes me mentally.
The state of enlightenment is a goal of all Buddhists, but in Chan Buddhism, it is not necessarily at the end of a long road of reincarnations.
The Chan school had this doctrine of sudden enlightenment. And they said that you really are already a Buddha. You just don't understand that. So it's nothing that you have to acquire through years and years of practice. It's really something that you just have to let shine through or to let come forward in the instant. And the moment you let go of all your discursive mental activity, the moment you let go of that inner voice and our inner desires and our wants, including the desire for enlightenment, at that point, you're a Buddha.
The home and birthplace of Chan Buddhism and Shaolin Kung Fu is this temple in central China. It dates back 1,500 years and has become a mecca for Kung Fu students from all over the world. Yan Ming started training to become a monk at the Shaolin Temple in China when he was only 5 years old. The training is rigorous and goes on for years. Bright and early each morning, students run up the steps of a steep hill and then crawl back down. As the training advances, the challenges become more strenuous. Xi Guolin also trained here. He wanted to become a monk when he was a little boy so he could fly. He did earn the revered Kung Fu title of Shaolin Hero.
When I was young, I trained Kung Fu 8 hours a day.
Every day, 8 hours?
Yes.
8 years?
Yeah.
Xi Guolin is in line to become the next abbot of the Shaolin Temple in China. He now operates a temple and school in Flushing, New York.
In here.
The first and one of the most important aspects of Shaolin Kung Fu is something called qi.
Qi embodies like air.
So breathing is very important in, Kung Fu.
Very, very important.
Yes.
Even not breathing, not life.
The notion of qi goes back thousands of years. It is considered to be a person's life force or energy. Cultivating qi, this inner power, is what Kung Fu is all about.
We walk 10 blocks, we don't feel tired, that's qi. If you walk 5 blocks, your legs feel heavy like 1,000 pounds, you cannot move forward, there's no qi.
It takes, for instance, an amazing control of qi to perform some of the martial arts shown here. Yan Ming and Xi Guolin have each performed these death-defying feats many times. There's yet another side of Kung Fu, the artistic side. It was on display in San Francisco recently. This was a rehearsal for a performance, a collaboration between Shaolin monks and the acclaimed Lions Ballet Company. The artistic director is Alonzo King.
A lot of times people will look at their movement and think, this looks violent, or it's preparing for some kind of struggle, but it's dancing.
But these students are not interested in dancing Kung Fu. They're more interested in the essentials of Shaolin philosophy. That means that while learning martial arts, they must also cultivate a sense of ethics, one that encompasses justice, diligence, honesty, hard work, and mental discipline. Melanie Low has been a student of Xi Guolin for 12 years.
He has a term called monkey mind, where we're not focused, we're thinking about all these other things in our life. And then he tells us to bring ourselves back here, back at the present moment, and practice and focus. Go! Go!
Go! And the ultimate goal of all this practice, this action meditation, is a state of enlightenment.
Strike!
Yan Ming says it's a very happy state to be in.
Have you achieved total enlightenment?
I achieved understanding myself clearly. Yes.
And what does that feel like?
I feel like a Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
Yan Ming says Kung Fu is for everyone, no matter what their religion, and that the world would be a more peaceful, happier place with action meditation. Then he says every day would be a holiday. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in New York City.
Finally, Christians and lions in Rome haven't always had the best relations over the centuries, but Pope Benedict apparently wanted to do his part to reach out. The circus was in town, and Benedict invited some of the performers to his weekly audience at the Vatican. After a rousing juggling act, one of the circus members brought up a lion cub for a personal introduction. It appeared some tensions may linger. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. There's much more on our website, including more on religion and politics on our One Nation page. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, gospel artist Wintley Phipps singing Amazing Grace at the recent National Prayer Service in Washington's National Cathedral.